Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namasami. Friends, I thought of speaking about resolutions today because it's the new year and it's a time when sometimes people think of evaluating themselves and making resolutions of things that they would like to do better. In the Pali, the word for a resolution is called an adhitana. Tana means to stand. Satipatthana is an upatthana, which is a foundation. So adhitana, adi is sticking. So if you're going to make a foundation and stick to it, put your stake in the ground, make a strong decision, that would be called an adhitana. For example, sometimes in going to a meditation retreat, they might encourage you to make a determination to attend every sitting, to be there on time, and to get into a posture and sit perfectly still without moving, no matter how painful it is, for the entire period of the meditation. And that's an adhitana. So you will have established or fixed a decision in the mind, and then later on, even though you really want to move or want to wiggle or want to stand, because of having made that adhitana, you might bear up to the pain and continue sitting throughout the whole hour. By the way, I'm not saying this to mean that I recommend that people sit through the whole session no matter what. Even today, we're lucky to have the beautiful example of Ayasiddhajana, who is working with a medical condition and with doctor's advice, is going very, very gently on the body in order to allow it to heal and to not let a temporary situation become a chronic health problem. Mm-hmm. And so knowing yourself and knowing what you do, I'm not saying that one should always do that, but I'm just giving that as an example of an adhitana. Another something about resolutions is, I think it's pretty well known that a lot of people will make a New Year's resolution and then they won't keep it for very long. By the end of January, it's forgotten. And another thing that's very well known is that, especially among Western meditators, people have a tendency to beat themselves up quite a lot because of thinking that they should be doing better than they are doing. So a person can make a resolution and then fail to keep the resolution and then feel shame and remorse about it, and then that becomes a fuel for actually a very unwholesome process. The hindrance that arises from that, it's very much related to the hindrance. There's five hindrances, which is sensual desire, hatred, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, that restlessness and worry is related to remorse, okay? And then a skeptical doubt. And I want to point out both restlessness and remorse and skeptical doubt can be related to an unskillful or misapplied way of trying to undertake making resolutions without having a smart strategy or without having the right amount of realism and self-kindness. Part of restlessness can come from a lot of different causes. Actually, any situation where you would like for reality to be different than what it is can give rise to restlessness. So if you're overtaken with desire, then you want to have something that you don't have, and that can cause restlessness. If you're overtaken with hatred, again, you want that so-and-so to not have all those qualities that are hateful to you. And again, that causes restlessness because of discontent. Then sometimes just the physical energies in the body can create restlessness. Sometimes in meditation, you feel like your skin is crawling and just too much tension. And it could be because, something happened that triggered a lot of thinking or took too much caffeine or any kind of number of reasons. But then this self-blame or remorse is something that can cause a lot of restlessness or a kind of a compulsive thinking process where one is reviewing what happened and trying to think, well, if only I had done something differently, it would have turned out differently, or something like that. The restlessness coming from anger and hatred, the cure for that is to develop contentment and to have enough detachment from your self-centered sensitivity that you just see things in this very cool and objective way, and you're just able to see just, well, it is what it is, and accepting reality just how it is. But then this other kind of restlessness that's related to a guilty conscience or feeling remorseful. In that case, I think you should train yourself. The Buddha taught us that what's called hiri and otapa are good things. That's what's translated as moral shame and moral dread. You could say that hiri is like an inner reflection of a social shame. Like if anybody saw me doing that, I would feel terribly embarrassed. And so I can sort of shame myself about it. Or I can, in a way, it's a reflection of self-respect. You say, well, I don't want to be the kind of person I'm not the kind of person who does that. And so that arouses hiri. And then otapa is the fear of the consequences. So if you think, well, if I... we were talking about this yesterday, someone said, well, if I work like a horse all my life, I'm going to be reborn as a horse. And so you're afraid of those consequences.
Right.
And so then you don't act in an animal way because you don't want to have that kind of a future. But hiri otapa is only good for a minute. are less than a minute. It's good for just a moment, just the time when you're coming up to where you have an opportunity to undertake some action. And then, so there's like an impulse to do something, and then Hiroyo Tapa comes up and says, wait. And she just said that pause long enough to consider it, and then it stops you from going forward. And then after that, Hiroyo Tapa has done its job. It's not the purpose of Hiroyo Tapa to then be beating yourself up for the following days, months, and years, and decades about something you did. All of that, the Buddha said, that's not worth, no point, no purpose in that. If we do something unskillful, then we have to develop contentment and say, well, this unskillful deed of mine may have some consequences, and I will accept the possibility that the consequences of my unskillful and unwise behavior could come to maturity, and it could be painful for me, but it's limited. And I make a determination not to repeat the same kind of thing again. And it might be there's some ways that you can help yourself to make that determination. So if you speak to a trusted, confidential friend or a mentor, and you say, well, I did this, and my determination is not to repeat that, that can help to change the mental pattern and make it less likely to repeat. But if you try to sweep it under the rug, then it's more likely to repeat. Restlessness and remorse don't use it to just beat yourself up uselessly. In the realm of the hindrance of skeptical doubt, that's frequently described in the main part of skeptical doubt is that one is doubting that this path is worthwhile, or doubting that there really are that it's really possible to be enlightened, or thinking, or those monks are all, you know, corrupt, and I don't trust them, or the teachers, I don't trust them. They're all out for a buck or trying to manipulate you or something. So that's a kind of doubt that you can see that's really poison to being able to practice. If you can't have some confidence that the path will work, or find a teacher for whom, when you see the model or the example that teacher is setting, then that increases your confidence and makes you think, well, yes, it is possible. If I practice like that, then I'm going to become more like that teacher, and that's the direction I want to go in. So there is that kind of confidence. And so then the opposite of that is skeptical doubt, that you're not able to trust anybody, not able to see the good in the learning opportunities that come our way, but instead always seeing the dangers or the negativities. Another part of skeptical doubt is feeling I'm not good enough for this practice. If you feel I don't have any willpower, I've been trying this meditation for so long, and still when I sit down the mind is restless, so I'm no good, I'm not able to meditate, I'm never going to be able to, it's my karma, I just should just go and do a lot of good deeds because I'll never be able to realize insight or something like that. And so that kind of self-doubt also is very toxic to practice, and I feel that when we make our resolutions with a lot of enthusiasm but without enough wisdom or enough skill, when we're not smart about it, then it could be that we'd be setting ourselves up in a way that can feed this self-doubt. Since I started pondering about this theme a while ago, I've been watching the all of the fluctuations of the sankhara of volitional intention. Our human being, you could say that a human being is can be analyzed in terms of the mind and the body, or the mentality and materiality. And you could say that the body is made up of physical elements, and the mental part of a human being could be broken down into feeling, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling. That's what is continuously arising. That's like the very first thing we experience when we have an experience. The Pali word Vedana, which is translated feeling, it also is sometimes is translated as experience. So if you're conscious and awake and you experience something, the very first part of it you experience is just this, it's almost, it's conscious, but it's not even yet verbalized. It's just if something is pleasing or inspiring or uplifting, you just can feel a kind of a relaxation and an opening up and a welcoming or accepting or turning towards that experience. And then if the experience is negative, dangerous, frightening, destabilizing in some way, then before you could even verbalize about it, you could feel this shrinking away, this turning away, this don't want to see it, closing down. So then conditioned or coming up almost the same time as the feeling is the perception, which is coming close to or rename something that we would recognize. Like I might recognize each person here according to their name. So, you know, I see you and I know who you are. Or it could be one is able to, with perception, one is able to divide our experiences into compartments. Like, the tile is sort of pink or orangey pink colored, and the grout is kind of gray. And so there's not that much difference in color, but I can clearly see the difference between the color of the grout and the color of the tile. So I made a separation there, separated them out. That's the other thing that perception does. And then the other important thing that perception does is you are taking your experience that you have in the here and now and calling up or actually recreating from memory the memory of that concept that has a name. So like when I was looking at the tile, I was trying to remember how to describe that color, right? So doing this, one thing that happens is that the memories that we have are filed in the mind, and in the same file drawer with the memory is the emotion associated with that object. So then, if you see, you know, there's something, you feel like danger, but you're not even sure what it is, okay? And then, an instant later, you would say, oh, it's a tiger. And then, you know, all that, everything that you've got, the horrible fear factor, comes up with the concept of tiger. Then you have all this knowledge about why you should be scared. And so then the perception has the function of creating a sort of a feedback loop with the vedana to intensify and build it up. It builds up the intensity of the vedana until finally it matures to a point where we need to do something about it, and that's where the sankhara, or the volitional formation, comes in. Now, just for your clarification, when you speak to other Buddhist philosophers, this whole process that I talked about of making the distinction between the ground and the tile, or the distinction between a tiger and another kind of animal, or the perception process, and then the proliferation process, and the whole thing, the overarching, everything is called sankhara. That's a formation. That's when you are like creating your world through the mind. So what you experience is, what you're experiencing is something that's happening in your mind. The whole thing is called sankhara, but a special use of sankhara is called volitional formation. That's when you are intending, you're arising the energy and become ready to do something. And so volitional formations are very important, because volitional formation, when you do something with intention, that creates a kamma. And in the Buddhist thought, the kammas that we do are very significant in setting up what's going to develop as far as our suffering, our freedom from suffering, our pain and pleasure in the future. So, volitions that are not accompanied by wisdom are otherwise frequently directed, especially by greed greed and hatred, and they could be unbiased because of a selfish point of view, and those kind of volitions have a high likelihood of resulting in unskillful karmas, which would mature into our future unhappiness. But when our intentions are pure from those unwholesome roots, when our intentions are guided by non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion, then volitions can be real wholesome and essential on the path. So I'm trying to suggest that when we come to make a resolution, we want to see, what color is this resolution? Is this resolution accompanied by non-greed or generosity, by non-hatred or loving-kindness, by non-delusion or by wisdom? And if we see that our intention has got that kind of a wholesome color, then we don't need to be afraid. We can continue, we can try to develop that and build it up. But when our intention is accompanied by those negative roots, then we better start being cautious and thinking, well, maybe it's not going to work out. So I'm going to stop now, and what I'm giving you is the suggestion for the rest of the day. Even though you think you're on the meditation cushion and you're not doing much with the intention, really you are, because like you intend to be here, you intend to not run screaming out of the hall and run away and go home. You intend to sit, you intend to practice, and you face, you know, certain kind of difficulties while you do that, or you intend to stay awake, or if you're practicing loving kindness or a particular practice, you intend to do that practice. And so those are the intentions. You don't have to think of your, like, your plans for your life. You can just think about the intentions that you have right here within this room and within this day, and see how much you're able to notice about your intentions. What color are they? Are they accompanied by these factors on the wholesome side or not? So that's my suggestion as we move into the next part of the program, which involves lunch. Thank you for your patience.
Sadhu, 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 anumodami.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.